We've been wearing masks for how long now? A new exhibit at Augustana University talks about just that. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, March 18th. This is In the Moment. A new exhibit at Augustana University, The Face Behind the Mask, takes a look at how mask wearing dates back quite some time. We head inside the House of Representatives and take a listen to discussion this past session over House Bill 1061, which deals with smoking and consuming marijuana in a motor vehicle. Kevin Wooster is with us. We'll talk about a difficult topic, the death penalty. Lawrence Diggs is back, but this time talking about a Zoom series developed to bring peace and unity. First, we spend a few minutes with Kim Malsom-Risden, South Dakota's Secretary of Department of Health, as they've announced the move to vaccinate those in Priority Group 1E, the last group. I'm Chris Loffrey, in today for Lori Walsh. The news is first.
I'm John Wynn with SDPB News. Attorneys general from 21 states, including South Dakota, are suing to overturn President Joe Biden's cancellation of the contentious Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada. Led by Ken Paxton of Texas and Austin Knutson of Montana, the state said in Wednesday's court filing that Biden overstepped his authority when he blocked the 1,200-mile-long pipeline on his first day in office. The attorneys general say Congress should have the final say on the project. The pipeline would carry crude from Western Canada's oil sands region to Gulf Coast refineries. Biden canceled its permit over longstanding concerns that burning the crude would make climate change worse. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals is hearing oral arguments today in a dispute between the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and Indian Health Services. The tribe sued IHS and Health and Human Services in 2016 after the Rosebud IHS Hospital's emergency department went on divert status. The tribe says patients were advised at the time to seek emergency services in off-reservation towns about 50 miles from Rosebud. The hospital also fell out of compliance with Medicare and Medicaid at about the same time. In its suit, the tribe held that the United States has a duty through the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 to provide quality health care. The tribe also claimed the government has an obligation through the Indian Health Care Improvement Act to raise the quality of care to the highest level. Federal Judge Roberto Lange ruled that the 1868 treaty does require the U.S. to provide competent physician-led health care. But he said the tribe overstates the government's obligations under other federal statutes. The government agencies denied having any fiduciary duty to provide health care for tribes, and they have appealed Judge Lange's judgment. SDPB's Victoria Wicks will have more thorough coverage after listening to oral arguments later today. The South Dakota Health Department will begin COVID-19 vaccinations for the last priority group beginning next Monday. Under Phase 1E, firefighters and people who work in critical infrastructure are eligible. That includes energy, manufacturing, and transportation. Secretary of Health Kim Malsom-Risden says the state will see more doses of all three federally approved vaccines.
Our allocation for next week stands at 21,000, and that includes 11,700 doses of Pfizer, 8,300 doses of Moderna, and 1,000 doses of the Janssen/Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Malsom-Risden says those total dose numbers do not include second doses. Health officials say roughly 35% of South Dakotans have had at least one dose of vaccine. Governor Kristi Noem says that two interim cabinet secretaries are getting the jobs permanently. Secretary Joel Junt of the Department of Transportation and Secretary Kevin Roebling with Game, Fish, and Parks will both continue to serve in their roles as secretaries to their departments. Noem says Roebling has a great understanding of the state's natural resource and conservation priorities. Regarding Junt's appointment, Noem says he has dedicated his life to promoting transportation access in South Dakota and has proven himself as a leader in the industry. For weather today, we're seeing sunny skies with highs in the lower 40s to the lower 50s. Later tonight, we'll see evening lows in the 20s, and that's going along with mostly clear skies. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Chris Loffrey in today for Lori Walsh. Just yesterday, the South Dakota Department of Health announced that beginning this Monday, March the 22nd, COVID-19 vaccinations are going to be made available for the last priority group, or Phase 1E. Kim Malsom-Risden heads the department, joins us once again. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
It seems to me that South Dakota may have got to this point quicker than expected. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, I think we've just been pleasantly surprised by how quickly we've been able to get people in and vaccinated. Of course, we've seen more vaccines coming to the state, both in terms of the state allocation and then in terms of the federal pharmacies that are getting a direct supply from the federal government. And so we've seen more of those sites come on board as well. So we have more options than ever for people to become vaccinated in South Dakota.
So 1E being the last group, it seems to be a pretty large group of people. Are you rather confident that doses are going to be available in mass quantity to make this happen?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we expect to get at least the amounts that we've been seeing on a weekly basis, and we really do expect there to be a large increase starting in April, and that I think will probably be vaccines that are allocated to the state, as well as to those pharmacy locations and other locations that are coming on board. So we really do anticipate things picking up in April and are confident that, you know, not only will we get through the 1E population, but we'll be able to get to the general population for adults in April as well.
So how has the process gone so far? And I'm guessing it's been a learning experience as each day passes. What have you learned so far that maybe you didn't know before?
Well, you know, it's really a kind of a wait and see thing on a week to week basis. So we're always anticipating what that allocation will look like. And then we're really comparing that to, you know, what the last week's data shows us in terms of where we've been able to vaccinate folks and where we might still need to do it. So I would just tell you that it's always evolving. And, you know, we're going to really continue to encourage people to become vaccinated when it's their turn. And we know so far we've seen great turnout amongst our 65 and older population, which, again, is going to be more vulnerable to COVID and, you know, poorer outcomes of COVID if they were to contract it. So, so far we're seeing a 74% vaccination rate amongst people 65 and older, and that's really, really great. But we're not done yet. And so if we've got folks that have been eligible for vaccine before now, maybe they just needed some time to think about it. You know, it's not too late. Please go and sign up and get your shot. That's going to be the way that we see the end of this pandemic.
You kind of touched on my next thought. What percent of the population from the first COVID groups has received the vaccine, particularly the one you just spoke of, age 65 and up? It says that we have 35% of the state's population with at least one shot on your website. But are we really reaching the 100% of each demographic, or are we at 90 or 50? Or what has the criteria been to move things along?
Yeah, so you know, our plan has been fluid, and we've recognized that it's going to need to be fluid so that we can continue to make sure that we're getting shots in arms and that we're not letting vaccines sit on the shelf or in the refrigerator. So our goal as a state is to see 70% of adults vaccinated, and so we are looking very much at the data on a regular basis to see how we're doing with different groups. And as we work through folks that are ready and willing to become vaccinated, we will also be circling back and, you know, really encouraging those folks that have had any hesitation so far to, you know, reconsider that. We know that the shots are safe. The vaccines are effective. And again, they're going to be our way out of this pandemic. So can't encourage it high enough.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Secretary of the Department of Health for South Dakota, Kim Malsom-Risden. Let's talk sheer numbers. More than 200,000 South Dakotans have received at least one dose of the vaccine, but there's really, if you will, no noticeable impact yet in the case numbers. And those numbers, they've plateaued since early February, and it makes me think, well, what's going on, and why aren't the case numbers going down?
Yeah, so I think that's a great point, Chris. And the fact is we do still have COVID circulating in our state. And so in addition to people getting vaccinated when they are eligible, we, you know, need to pay attention to those mitigation strategies. We need, you know, to stay away from people to the greatest extent possible. If you can't stay away from folks, make sure you wear a mask. Good hand hygiene, cough etiquette. Those things are still really important because, as you said, we are still seeing cases. Now, where we have seen improvement is in the number of people that have been hospitalized, and we've been seeing the lowest levels of people in the hospital for quite some time. And again, seeing those vaccination rates amongst our older people is a really good sign and a really good progress in terms of our vaccination strategy.
Let's also note that the death numbers have gone down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so let's note that. But let's in Rapid City, if you will, probably elsewhere too, there's lots of rumors floating around and even some confirmed reports that vaccines are being made available to pretty much anybody. So all along, have we really been following the plan or some doing the plan? Not should people really wait to be declared eligible or should they just go try to get this vaccine wherever they can?
Well, you know, I think part of what you might be hearing about are certain situations and limited situations where, you know, we haven't wanted to waste vaccine. That's been a key principle, you know, that we've had as a state is that vaccines and arms are really what we're about. And so when you think about how these vaccines are administered, they come in vials of either 5 to 6 or 10, you know, doses per vial. And so if we see a situation out there where a vial might be opened and maybe, you know, the sixth appointment didn't show up, we'd rather see that sixth dose, again, be used for somebody who wants to be vaccinated than thrown away. And so I do think that there's been some limited situations where that's the case. The other thing I would tell you is that, you know, as we see more and more vaccine access points, you know, there's just, you know, more communication for everybody to make sure that they understand kind of where we're at as a state. And we're working really hard on that so that we're seeing a consistent rollout of the state's vaccination plan.
You've been gracious with your time. I have one final thought, and you touched on it slightly. I've read some reports, and they're disturbing to me, not from South Dakota, but some states will publish or post, if you will, the fact that they are discarding some vaccines for a number of reasons. And that, like I said, that bothers me on many levels, but South Dakota hasn't had that problem, correct?
Right. We've seen a very minimal amount of wastage. We do monitor that very, very closely. We've seen less than 200 cases of that, you know, and again, out of, you know, hundreds of thousands of doses administered. And the reasons we see that happen on a very rare occasion are, you know, just, you know, situations where, you know, a needle breaks maybe within the vial, and obviously we can't use the vial after that, or we weren't able to pull the sixth dose out of that, you know, particular vial. We could only get 5.5, and so, you know, part of that would be wasted. So we do monitor that very closely, and thankfully have not seen big issues here.
Beginning Monday, March 22nd, 1E, Phase 1E in South Dakota, COVID vaccinations are going to be made available for that group. Our guest has been Kim Malsom-Risden, Secretary of the Department of Health for South Dakota. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Chris. Have a good day.
You as well. Up next, in their own words, you're listening to In the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, the investigation into possible criminal misconduct by Donald Trump, an investigation led by Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance Jr. We'll talk with Jane Mayer, who reports in The New Yorker that the investigation has intensified since Trump left office, and it's one of the most significant legal showdowns in American history. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Yak Ridge Cabins and Farmstead. Your year-round Black Hills adventure awaits with private cabins, modern amenities, and Himalayan yaks. Social distance stays minutes from Mount Rushmore and Hill City. More at yak-ridge.com.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Boys State Basketball Tournament. You can watch all the action Thursday, March 18th through Saturday, March 20th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Boys State Basketball Tournament brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corps.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
In Their Own Words brings you closer to the debates and conversations behind legislative topics. It's supported by SDN Communications.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey, in today for Lori Walsh. The legislative session in South Dakota is over. The last couple of months, we've brought you inside the chambers of the State Capitol Building in Pierre for a series called In Their Own Words. Today, we listen back to testimony from the House of Representatives on House Bill 1061 from February 25th.
House Bill 1061, an act to prohibit smoking and consuming marijuana and its derivatives in a motor vehicle and create a penalty therefore.
House Bill 1061, having had its second reading, is now for consideration. Final passage, Representative Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I come before you today with House Bill 1061. 1061 is an act to prohibit smoking and consuming marijuana and its derivatives in a motor vehicle. The purpose of this bill is to deter the use of marijuana in a motor vehicle. To put it simply, this is comparable to an open container law we currently have regulating alcohol. So I want you to bear with me for a second here. Section 1 says that the driver of an automobile cannot smoke marijuana or its derivatives or consume it. Keep that in mind. Section 2 says that a passenger in a car cannot smoke marijuana. So keep those two separate things in mind. So let's say it's July 31st and you can have medical marijuana in your car and you have a card. If you are the person that is ill and that has the card, you can be a passenger in that car and suck on a lozenger, eat a gummy, however that doctor prescribes that medication to you. That is fine. But if you are smoking in the motor vehicle, smoking your marijuana, we're saying that you as a passenger cannot smoke, nor can the driver of that automobile smoke. So let's compare it to open container. It's not illegal for me to have a six-pack or a bottle of whiskey in my car. But once I open that and start consuming that, that is illegal. So it's the same thing. Think of smoking as drinking. Now, this bill was brought about because after July 1st, and perhaps the recreational marijuana will be legal on November 1st. You would be able to possess that marijuana in your car and smoke it. There'd be no law on the books that said it was illegal for you to smoke that marijuana. So this is why this bill was prepared. Why was it prepared? It was to protect our highways and keep our roads safe.
Thank you. Further remarks? Are there any further remarks on 1061? Representative Pischke.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, if you look at the vote count for this, I was the one no vote up in committee. And while I do appreciate the intentions of this piece of legislation, I do think that there are still some, I think there's some side effects that we need to consider here. So if you look at Section 1 of the bill, we're talking about consumption, right, of marijuana or smoking. And I can go with the smoking thing, but we do realize that medical marijuana is coming in the state of South Dakota. It's just how it is. Thank you. And we are going to have constituents who are going to have medical cards, and medical marijuana is going to be legal for them. Now, let's say your arthritis flares up. You're an old person, your arthritis flares up. You have a medical card for that. You're driving in rush hour traffic in Sioux Falls, and you decide that you're going to pop a couple gummies to take care of your pain that you have while you're driving. Now, what's worse? Are you going to say that these people need to drive home before they can deal with their pain? Or should we make them a criminal under the statute? That's where I am. I'm not going to make these people a criminal. I'm going to say that they still should be allowed to pop their gummies and deal with their pain. So I realize this is probably going to pass, but I'm asking the body to throw up some red. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks. Representative Fitzgerald, would you like to close us out?
This bill was prepared because marijuana is going to be becoming legal in South Dakota, whether we like it or not. So we've got to be prepared. This is a public safety bill. It's put forth to try to protect the residents, the people of South Dakota. I thought it was a really easy bill, but I guess sometimes people are confused by it. So I wrote this little thing that I would like to say at the end just to kind of be lighthearted about it. You can smoke marijuana in your house. You can smoke marijuana with your spouse. You can smoke marijuana while you play your guitar, but never ever smoke marijuana in your car. Vote for this. I hope you will.
Only if you promise not to do that again. Question for the body is final passage of 1061. All those in favor will vote yay. Those opposed, nay. Madam Clerk, please unlock the voting machine. Would the members proceed to vote?
Mr. Speaker, all members have voted.
Please display the vote.
Mr. Speaker, there were ayes 61, nays 6, excused 3.
House Bill 1061, having received a majority vote of the members elect, is hereby declared passed. Are there any questions on the title? Hearing none, the title is deemed correct.
House Bill 1061 passed both chambers and is now on the governor's desk awaiting her signature. You can hear the complete hearing testimony at sd.net. Follow the SD Legislature link in the meeting archives section. Up next, a conversation with Lawrence Diggs about a new Zoom series developed to bring peace and unity. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, alto saxophonist Corey Weeds plays some Italian music, and Professor Cunningham and his old school get together virtually for some lockdown tunes. From Cleveland, we've got some funky jazz from tenorman Matthew Alec, and from Sioux Falls, it's the JAS Quintet. Plus, there are classic tracks from trombonist J.J. Johnson and vocalist Sarah Vaughn. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting Voting Why It Matters, featuring virtual events with authors, activists, and scholars, including Gloria Steinem, Louise Erdrich, and Thomas E. Patterson. More at sdhumanities.org.
Arts, literature, and music reporting on SDPB is supported by the Northern State University School of Fine Arts. More information available at northern.edu.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey, in for Lori Walsh today. The South Dakota Humanities Council, in cooperation with longtime SDHC scholar Lawrence Diggs, has developed a program to bring people peace and unity during these trying and divisive times. It's called Brainstorming the Human Condition Series. Lawrence Diggs joins us today with more. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Diggs.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We'll get to it here in a second, but it was nice to see you all, be at Zoom today.
yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about
thank
this.
You for joining us.
You betcha. Take us back to its infancy of this program and the initial thoughts on developing this. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I was sort of fishing around for a way to get people to talk with each other. Mm-hmm. And I'm a humanities scholar, so that conversation came up with the Humanities Council just in terms of the things that I was doing. And they thought, oh, well, that could be a very interesting series and something we might want our constituents in the state to be and to have the advantage of utilizing that. The premise for the show was that we wanted people to have conversations. There was a belief that there's not enough conversations, often because we don't know how to have conversations, but there weren't enough conversations between people where they felt safe, you know, where people could ask questions, be involved, have a difference of opinion. But at least we would like people to have considered opinions and considered thoughts. That is to say that before you ask someone else to accept your position, well, you know, put some stress on it yourself. Mm-hmm. All that said, you know, we thought, well, just let's try something. And so that's basically what we're doing. We're still in the formative stages of seeing how it goes, what kind of people are attracted to it, how we might best help them to have a conversation, and bringing about critical conversations that people will need to connect with each other. So the emphasis is on having people connect with each other and also giving people a platform to crowdsource solutions for the kind of social problems that we find ourselves confronted with.
So are you comfortable with how things have progressed so far? Are they going as planned?
To some degree, mm-hmm. You know, I like the way the format is developing. We could always use more people who are involved with it, and we're still working on, well, how do we let people know? Because when we let people know, they engage with us. But we haven't quite found the best formula for getting more people involved, though we have sort of two levels. One level is the participant level, and the other level is through putting it out on Facebook so people can listen but not be involved. So the listenership, you know, that's one level. But what I'm really looking for is more participants, more people who bring different ideas. So we may have a guest, and that guest will present a certain perspective. And we want people to engage with that person about that subject. And it's not important to agree, but have considered, you know, objections or comments or questions and things like that. So it's still developing, but I'm, you know, objectively, I'm happy with it.
So for the next few moments, the floor is yours, Mr. Diggs. How do people participate in this?
Well, basically, they log on to our Zoom conference, and they can log on to the Zoom conference by going to the South Dakota Humanities website's webpage, and then they can log on from there or, you know, connect to the Zoom link or get the Zoom link. And then they log on. We start every Thursday mm-hmm. at 10:30, and we go to about 11, somewhere between 11:30 and 12. Our target is to be done by 11:30, but if the conversation gets lively, then, you know, we'll go a little further. But our let's say, drop-dead stop is mm-hmm. at 12 o'clock.
The website you speak of is sdhumanities.org. That's sdhumanities.org. You mentioned guests earlier, and we also talked about how we saw each other today on Zoom, because I joined at 10:30, and your guest today was Jeremy Fugelberg, and you talked about something we've talked about at great length on this show for the last 15 months, coronavirus and the media. How do you feel that the session went today?
I think it went very good. Jerry is one that's been sort of in on the front lines, in the thick of it, so he knows very much how difficult it is to broach this subject. And he talked a lot about, you know, how just the words, finding the words to communicate something that's new to mm-hmm. the public, and also communicating with a public that is not very, let's say, conversant in scientific jargon, and that means you have to change the words to fit what people know, but often those lay terms don't really accurately express what the $20,000 words express. And so there's sometimes the miscommunication and disconnect. Sometimes people, they're used to having absolutes, like in religion, where they say, well, this is true and it's always going to be true. But in science, we don't do absolutes. We do probabilities and tentative conclusions until some new information is presented, and then we change our minds. Well, lots of people are not used to thinking in that way. So when you try to write a story about it, that can be problematic.
We're talking with Lawrence Diggs. He's the longtime South Dakota Humanities Council scholar. We're discussing the Zoom series, Brainstorming the Human Condition series. Now that this one is over for this week, Mr. Diggs, what was your takeaway? What stuck out to you the most?
Well, I think the thing that stuck out the most was how much we have to do to connect our fellow South Dakotans in particular, and the public in general, to ways of communicating that have to do with data that is maybe a little bit unusual for people. And in fact, even, you know, we talk about science as it's one monolithic thing, but really the person who is in geology may be just as unfamiliar with virology as the general public, because that isn't the kind of science they talk about. So trying to make different scientific discoveries in the different fields available to people in a form that they can understand without having to go back to college and get a PhD in that subject, that's a challenge for us. But all of those things are important, and also, you know, it becomes political. Because, you know, anytime we're going to make a decision that has to do with elected leaders, then that becomes political just by definition. So it sort of behooves, or it's important for all of us to find ways to communicate that better to people who, quite frankly, are mostly engaged with just trying to hang on by their fingernails. So it's a very complex and a very challenging effort.
If you think about it, the nuts and bolts of this whole thing is we haven't seen a pandemic in 100 years, in a century. Mm. So we, in a sense, everybody has been learning as we go.
Yes, we're all been learning, and science is learning. And some of the things I think science knew but forgot about it, for example, this whole idea of masking. Every time we've had a pandemic in the past, since this Chinese guy did some studies and figured out that was, I think, back in the flu epidemic. We've known over time that that is one of the key things that you could do, and is to stop the transmission. And one of the most effective ways to stop the transmission is with masking. That's not new science, but the way it came into our culture, it felt like it was new. But you could go back in this country and people were asked to put on masks, and they had the same reaction as we have now. So in some way, we should have been able to predict what the public's reaction was going to be, because we've seen this show before. This is really a rerun with just maybe a new cast, but the show is the same.
Yeah, and we could spend the next 10 minutes or for longer talking about that one show, but I want to move into the next one because, well, first, before I do that, my thought is this is open to participation from anybody, right? Nobody's excluded.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Except Zoom bombers. Don't want them.
Coming up next.
But other than that, everybody's welcome.
Coming up next Thursday at 10:30 in the morning on Zoom, this series continues, and this is a good one. I mean, they're all good, but this is a timely. Neutralizing violence. Talk about that.
Well, yeah. One of the efforts I've been trying to explore is our ability to neutralize violence. That is to say, not combat it, but make it less effective to the point that people don't use it, and it or it doesn't work. Violence is usually used to terrorize people in terms of an organized thing. Sometimes people do violent things just because they're, I call it the emotionally vomiting, you know. But a lot of times violence is used to intimidate people and manipulate them, whether it's through war or formal terrorism or otherwise. So I'm looking for, you know, how do we find ways to make it so that violence doesn't work? I think if we can't do that, as long as violence works, then people will continue to use violence, and we will end up having to use violence to subdue violence. And so that ends up being a kind of mad circle and spiral that we just all spiral down back to dragging our knuckles if we allow that to continue. So I'm looking for ways to crowdsource how do we neutralize it? And that may involve helping people to find the courage not to respond to violence or to respond to it in some other way that neutralizes it, that makes the person who's perpetrating the violence rethink what they're doing. So this is more than this is the answer to it. It's a call to crowdsource an answer to it, because I think all of us have some of the answers, and if we can put those pieces together, we can come up with at least something reasonable to try.
If that series interests you, I encourage you to jump online, sdhumanities.org. Next Thursday at 10:30 is Neutralizing Violence. April 1st is Fiction and Lying with Patrick Hicks, who's been a guest on this show several times. Followed by April 8th, that's going to be a very interesting one too, Mr. Diggs, identifying how hate is spread throughout South Dakota. And your guest is going to be Taniza Islam. She's also been on this show several times. Real quick, again, it's absolutely free. How do people get involved?
Just sign on. You don't have to, sign away your birthright or give away your firstborn or anything like that. You just sign up and join the discussion. Basically, go to the website, and then we put you on a mailing list that you get a notification of when we're going to have what the next show is going to be about. But if you just come to, you know, once you get the link, you. You just go on to that Zoom link every Thursday at 10:30 in the morning.
Lawrence Diggs, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
The boys' state basketball tournaments are underway today in three different locations. The AA tournament is at the Rushmore Plaza Civic Center in Rapid City. None of the Rapid City schools qualified. Three Sioux Falls teams are participating, including number one seed Sioux Falls, Washington. Mid-40s for highs today, but how about highs in the 60s for Friday and Saturday in the West? Across the state, Sioux Falls is hosting the Class A tournament at the Danny Sanford Premier Center. Vermilion is the number one seed, and they're currently facing Dale Rapids. Sunny skies and highs from the mid-40s to mid-50s will greet tournament goers over the next 3 days. And the boys' state B is in Aberdeen at the Barnett Center on the campus of Northern State University. This is the 23rd trip to the state tournament for the top-seeded DeSmet Bulldogs. Highs in the northeastern South Dakota will gradually increase to highs near 60 on Saturday and Sunday. Championship games are scheduled for Saturday evening. If you can't attend, you can watch all three tournaments on SDPB TV channels 1, 2, and 3. You can watch online, sd.net or sdpb.org/basketball. The public is invited to attend the Cub Scouts Pinewood Derby at Northridge Plaza in Pierre. Packs 127, 273, and 391 are competing Saturday from 10 until noon. Augustana University's third Sunday archaeology lecture series continues Sunday at noon, or two rather, via Zoom. Dr. Mike Waters, distinguished professor of anthropology and director of the Center for the Study of First Americans at Texas A&M University, presents Ice Age Explorers of the Americas, what the archaeological and genetic evidence tells us about the initial peopling of the Americas. We'll have more in just a bit as we welcome in Dr. Adrian Hannes. Events are happening all over South Dakota. See our list by visiting sdpb.org. Up next, Kevin Wooster is with us to offer his latest on the Other Hand blog. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. The world of comedy writing has long been dominated by men, but there's a new collection of humor writing from 150 women in comedy, and they're not afraid to get raunchy.
Let's be clear, there's a lot more than peeing and farts in this book.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you, still providing the same quality service you've come to expect. Doing our part to keep you safe at Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City.
Experts predict that baby births will go down as a result of the economic uncertainty of the pandemic, but that's not true for everyone.
This pandemic is unprecedented in our lifetimes, but there have been other pandemics and really horrific global catastrophes that we as humanity have gone through.
Being pregnant during the pandemic. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
State House coverage by Boyce Law Firm. Building lasting relationships that transcend generations. Whether planning for business succession or your legacy through estate planning, we have expertise you can rely on. Experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey in for Lori Walsh today. Each week, Kevin Wooster puts pen to paper, or these days, maybe it's mind to keyboard. His product is, on the other hand, a blog that can be found at sdpb.org. He joins us today to talk about a topic that most tend to not want to talk about, and that's the death penalty. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back. And not necessarily to talk about this, but obviously it's an extraordinarily important issue. So, as you know, it was up in the legislature again this year, thanks primarily to one guy.
Exactly. Yes, this is the topic, Kevin, but most importantly, it's about South Dakota Senator Art Rush.
Yeah, and, you know, former judge, former prosecutor, been around a long time, about my age, Catholic guy like me, and those kinds of things. You know, when you get to be in my position, you can kind of pick and choose what you want to write about and things that interest you and people that interest you. And so I wanted to not just talk about the death penalty with Art, but also to talk about how his Catholicism may have informed his decision making on that, and obviously his experience as a judge and having an unenviable job of sentencing someone to death, which I think most of us would not want to have to do.
I was just going to say that him being of the Catholic faith, that had to pose some difficulties for him, I'm sure, at times.
You know, it did. That's the Catholic Church's position on the death penalty has clarified in recent decades and recent years. And there was a time when there was some allowances made. It was discouraged. It was considered, something that the civilized societies shouldn't do and shouldn't have to do if they had secure penal systems that could protect the citizens and protect the people, that the corrections people. And by and large, now the church says, really, and especially in the modern world, there's no way to justify the death penalty. And Art's decision on his doing his job as a judge in a state that has a legal death penalty and condones its use, and he had to talk about that with his minister, with his pastor, and search his soul and, you know, conclude that he had a job to do. That I think while we allow our faith to inform our decision-making, a lot of times professionals that are dealing with a law that may not adhere strictly to that faith have to depart from it a little bit. And I think that's probably what he had to do in that situation.
A portion of your blog, Kevin, really, I mean, it struck me, and it struck me like nothing else. It was a quote from Mr. Art Rush that he's been in positions that not many people can say they've done. And this quote was, "But when you look across the desk at somebody and sentence them to death, it changes you." I can't even imagine. I'm sure he had more to say about that after saying that sentence, Kevin.
He did. And you know, I've spoken to people, my friend Pat Duffy, who was a lawyer here in town and defended a death a person that was up for death penalty. I think he would tell you that it changed him. I would guess Mike Butler, the lawyer down in Sioux Falls, defense lawyer, would tell you that it changed him, and certainly Art, who made that call across the desk, he would tell you it had changed him. He has some PTSD probably because of it, and it carried him into the legislature at the urging of former Governor Dennis Stuart. He ran for the legislature and is now in his fourth state Senate term. And he has been bringing this issue up because he believes it changes all of us. It changes society when the state sanctions killing like this. And I think his arguments are profound and articulate and worth hearing. And they aren't well received in terms of passage in the legislature, but I think it's a conversation that he believes in, and I certainly believe is worthy to have every year in this state.
He was involved in a pretty high-profile case. In fact, he sentenced somebody to the death penalty, and those that have been around South Dakota long enough know exactly who we're talking about, but I'm going to let you talk about that individual.
Yeah, the horrible case in the 90s when 9-year-old Becky O'Connell was kidnapped and raped and murdered. She was just on her way to an area grocery store, and Donald Mahler was later found and charged and convicted of that. Convicted twice, actually, because he was convicted once in trial and sentenced to death. And that was overturned by Supreme Court ruling on some evidence questions. And so Art Rush got the second trial, and that was in Rapid City. He was moved to Rapid City, and so he was out there. And again, Donald Mahler was found guilty and sentenced to death, and Art Rush was the one that did that. And of course, you know, and these are the points where I think I say in there somewhere that nobody would argue that on a scale of who deserves to live and die, that Donald Mahler deserved to live. But, you know, that isn't the point if you are against the death penalty, and if you are consider yourself fully pro-life, life has value, and it isn't for us to decide what that value is and who lives and who dies in a situation that's not self-defense or, you know, the kind of situation that develops in a war and things like that. And so you had this person that, by all accounts, was, you know, a person of you know, damaged goods emotionally and mentally and his, maybe in his soul. I don't know if we can go there, but did this horrid thing, this horrific thing, and many people, including some very good people with the pro-life positions, believed that the death penalty was the appropriate way to go. Still do believe that.
I once overheard a conversation that didn't involve me about this case. They didn't know who the judge was. In this case, it was Art Rush. They did know who the person was being charged. And the words were, and I couldn't believe I heard this, is, well, that judge didn't have a choice. He was forced to make that decision. I don't know if I agree with that. I think he did have a choice, and he's the judge. Am I wrong by saying that?
Well, that's a good. It would be a good question to ask Art. I mean, were there opportunities there? And, you know, that's something he and I didn't talk about very much. I think that's something I may follow up with, but that I think his belief was in the laws that we have in this state and the way the criminal justice system has defined this particular action in this state as acceptable in these cases, you know, and there's a series of things that have to be met before you can seek the death penalty and impose the death penalty. And it's done fairly rarely here compared to some states that have it. I think he felt like that was his duty apart from his personal beliefs. You know, it's like legislators who say or you know, do you follow the Bible or do you follow the Constitution in some of these things? And most people that I know may be informed by their beliefs in the Bible, but they would follow the Constitution if there was a conflict there. And I think that's what Art did here, and it was obviously a horribly difficult personal conflict, and one that he still lives with every day. And as he says in my blog, he weeps unabashedly. You know, he's not ashamed to weep when he presents these arguments before lawmakers.
His blog is On the Other Hand. He's Kevin Wooster. It's always a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Chris. See you.
Well, The Face Behind the Mask is a new exhibit at the I.D. Dalrymple Gallery at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. The man behind This exhibit is Adrian Hannes, professor of anthropology and the director of the Archaeology Lab. Mr. Hannes, welcome back to In the Moment.
Sounds good.
Talk about this exhibit, and please tell us how it came about. Take us back to the beginning.
Well, every other year I teach a class in museum methods here as part of our anthropology major program, and the students then become involved in working on an installation. This year, of course, became more difficult because of the COVID situation, but for some years I have been very interested in masking and the deep, deep time of human prehistory that falls back to the early shaman curing people in the Pleistocene, in other words, going back into the at least deep time of the Ice Age. They were individuals who, in their particular cultural groups, were the ritualists who tried to cure people and tried to, you know, restore equilibrium when various tragic events happened to groups. And so the shaman probably are the earliest group that we recognize anthropologically as those who would have been costumed and masked, protecting themselves against the spirit world, which they were then encountering to try to recover the lost souls of the sick and of the dying and so forth. So there's a very deep time story here behind masking. And of course, then if you follow the thread forward, cultures throughout the world have, through time and space, practiced masking, because again, the traditional way in which curing people, medicine men and so on, worked was to hide their identity from the spirit world so they could enter into the spirit world and you know, work with the spirit world. So in any case, I, going way back to graduate school, have had quite a considerable interest in the importance of masking in human cultural groups. And so in this case, we put together a idea for the exhibit that would include masks from basically a very broad swath across the world. In other words, we include cultures from about 10 different culture zones of the world, and but we start with images of some of the shaman costumes that date back into deep time and then come forward. And I guess that, of course, now part of this exhibit also includes a plague doctor's mask, which speaks to the period of the bubonic plague when individuals were masked and had their masks filled with various aromatics and so on when they tried to deal with the victims of the plague. And then, of course, in this particular moment in time, because of the COVID situation, we brought it forward all the way to the contemporary, showing some COVID masks, actually. So again, the discussion is about the deep time cultural background of masking itself, and then showing that masks are, you know, continue to be with us today. And of course, it becomes, like I say, rather intriguing because of the pandemic situation that masks have become quite a major topic of our preservation. So
the face behind the mask is a new exhibit at Augustana University. It opens today, actually, and runs through Friday, April 16th. And you'll have a talk at 7:15 Central Time tomorrow night, albeit virtually. Which platform are you using for that, and what will that look and sound like?
It's a Zoom platform, and I guess that folks can get into it by getting onto the Augustana University webpage. Just go down, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and the Zoom link is there advertised as part of the exhibit. So, and I believe that we'll probably go online around 7 o'clock, and then my understanding is that about 7:15, Dr. Lindsay Twa, who's the gallery director, is going to engage me in a, you know, sort of visit a few of the pieces that are in the exhibit to get some of my comments, and then it'll be able to be opened up, I think, if folks wish to, you know, ask questions after we go through a very brief presentation of the material. And, of course, one of the things that happens here because of the, you know, situation, the restrictions around COVID, is why it's being done as a virtual gallery reception, although then the exhibit, as you indicated, is open until the 16th of April, and people can certainly come over and visit the gallery. If we were just trying to avoid having large numbers of people, because our gallery receptions over the years have, you know, usually brought in maybe 100 or 125 folks in an evening to look at the pieces and so on. So we thought we couldn't really have that kind of a number of folks to deal with, you know, for the reception itself. But I sure hope, though, that people will visit the exhibit, you know, on their leisure. We're open on a daily basis, Monday through Friday. The exhibit will be open from 10 in the morning until 5 in the evening. Mm-hmm. And then on Saturdays, the gallery is open from 1 to 4. So, and we're closed on Sundays. So
the website you speak of that's of importance here is Augie. That's augie.edu. Check that out. It's The Face Behind the Mask. It sounds like a fascinating exhibit. Before we run out of time, about a minute left, Adrian Hannes. The third Sunday is this coming Sunday, March the 21st. And I talked about it earlier. Talk about that that event.
Well, this is our 38th year for hosting these third Sunday afternoon archaeological talks, and it's at 2 o'clock, and it will be a Zoom event as well. But this speaker for the March talk is Dr. Mike Waters. He's at Texas A&M University, and he's one of the leading archaeologists working with the early peopling of the New World. And so he'll be giving a presentation entitled Ice Age Explorers of the Americas and What the Archaeological and Genetic Evidence Tells Us About the Initial Peopling of the Americas. And Mike is a very, very interesting individual, and I think folks would enjoy very much being able to tune in. And again, after he gives his lecture, there will be an opportunity for people to, you know, ask questions. So I certainly invite everyone that has an interest, because there is a lot of new evidence that is built in the last decade or so, showing us that the earliest peopling of the New World has been pushed back probably 5,000 or 6,000 years from where it has been placed for so many years. So these will be a discussion about probably pre-Clovis people. The Clovis culture for many, many years was considered to be the most ancient culture that peopled the New World, but we now believe maybe reaching back more like, you know, probably 18 to 20,000 years.
Adrian Hannes, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. Be sure and visit augie.edu. It's going to be an amazing exhibit. Thank you for listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio.